Jerry Martin is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where executioners are preparing to put Jerry Martin to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Dennis Longmire. Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. Featured guest, Dr. Joel Zivit, whose journal article on physicians and the death penalty asserts the absence of cruelty is not the presence of humaneness. The execution watch for Jerry Martin begins.
Good evening. This is Ray Hill. It is Execution Watch on radio station KPFT Houston. We're also broadcast on the internet at kpft.org and at www.executionwatch.org if you want to call your friends and get them listening up. Jerry Martin is scheduled to be executed tonight. Is that Dennis on the line? Is that Dennis? Okay, I put Dennis on. Dennis.
Yes, hello, Ray.
Hey, Professor, what's going on in Huntsville?
Well, the witnesses for the media have just crossed the street and entered the walls unit. And so as you know, and to let all of your listeners know, that means that the execution is going forward as scheduled. They don't bring any witnesses in until until, as they say, the inmate has been rigged and is ready. So Mr. Martin is currently on the execution gurney waiting for the witnesses to proceed in. I do not know if there are any witnesses for Mr. Martin.
There will be. I know that for a fact because we've had some communications with Jerry. They will be there. And so they are awaiting their turn to cross the road.
Correct.
The reason we get a report from outside the death house in Huntsville is because unless the witnesses cross the road, the road is really 12th Street in Huntsville, unless they cross from the old administration building into the walls and that leads to the death chamber, we do not know that the procedure is going to go through. And at this point, because Jerry basically has asked that his attorneys to drop the appeals and allow it to go forward. Jerry is what we call a volunteer at this point. And Dennis, we think, how many vigilants are there?
Well, on this side of the street, there is a fairly large group of about 20 people who have come up from Houston. They're from the Straight Jesuit community.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to that 20, there are about 15 of us, a couple of Jerry's family members, his brother is here on the corner, and other regular vigilers, if that's a noun, I'm not sure, are here. And so I would say on this corner, probably 30 people maybe.
Mercy.
I know that there is also another group of vigilers on the other corner. It's opposite the administration building from us. We cannot see it, but I know that there are correctional officers and other people who support this execution who are over there. And so there's probably a number of people there, but I can't tell you how many.
Well, let me explain to the audience that when the victim in a homicide that results in an execution is either a police officer or a prison guard, there is always a pro-execution vigilant committee that go to Huntsville and demonstrates in favor of the execution. And that's a traditional thing. And since the victim in this case was a prison guard, they may actually still be on payroll and out there in this weather demonstrating for this killing. Dennis, Tell us what you do for a living.
I am a professor of criminal justice here at Sam Houston State University. I've been here since 1984 and have been coming to the corner in opposition to the executions since I arrived, and stand in opposition to the death penalty in general. I'll add, this is a particularly poignant and very difficult execution for me to be at for a number of reasons. The victim, Susan Canfield, is a member of my community. She's a person who people here have a great deal of respect for. She was a prison guard who was killed in the line of duty. She is a hero in a number of different ways. I was a correctional officer for a period of time before I went to graduate school, and so I understand the vulnerability that people who wear that uniform put themselves in an effort to make us as a general community feel safe. I'm not supportive of anything that is going on, but it's a difficult moment for this community. It's a hard moment for everybody who's involved in it. And this particular execution touches just about everyone in Huntsville because it is such a local event. And it's complicated. I oppose the killing of Jerry Martin. I don't think that it's necessary, and I don't think that it's productive. But at the same time, I'm very, very sad and sorry for the family of Susan Canfield and all of her supporters and the people who work in the system. It's a particularly troubling execution for me at the moment.
Well, Professor, I'm going to thank you for sharing that with you. That's a very poignant and important part of the story. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
And so Dennis Longmire is with Sam Houston University. You can reach him at Sam Houston University. What's his email address, Dennis? I guess he's gone.
Oh, no, I'm here.
Okay,
I'm
what's the best email address for you?
The best email address is longmire@shsu.edu.
Thank you, sir, and good night.
Thank you. Bye.
I believe we have Dave Atwood on the line. Dave, where are you?
Yeah, I'm here.
You're on the air.
Okay. Well, Ray, we're out here at the corner of Alameda and Holcomb by the Dominican Sisters. We've got 9 people here tonight and some new people. It's a good turnout.
Oh, okay. You got 9 people there. They've got a pretty good-sized crowd on our side in Huntsville. And a crowd in favor of execution over on the other side.
Right.
And
let me just mention something. Dennis mentioned the students from Straight Jesuit High School that are up there. There's a teacher at that high school who takes his students or takes a group of students up there every year. Normally, I go up with them. I couldn't go this time because I have a conflict this evening, but this particular teacher does a really good job in bringing forth the whole subject of the death penalty to the students at Straight Jesuit High School, and I think he's got about 10 students with him. I actually went over earlier in the day and spoke to him about, you know, what they were going to be experiencing tonight, and it's just another way that our movement moves forward and grows. I really admire this particular teacher for doing this. And I think this is the 3rd or 4th year in a row that he's done it. So they are this group of students. And they're, you know, lots of times this will really be a unique experience for them because this isn't something they do in their ordinary daily life, obviously.
David, can you tell folks how to get in touch with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty?
Sure. Our email or website is tcadp.org. tcadp.org. And that gives a lot of information there on what's going on around the state with executions, but also educational programs. And it's not just obviously, it's not just Houston or Austin. It's what's going on around the state. I mean, for instance, there are vigils. A lot of people don't realize this, but there are vigils taking place in many different places tonight. This, you know, up in Austin, College Station, El Paso. There's a group up in Lubbock that are having it. It's all really all over the place. And so it's an indication of the movement is growing. It doesn't grow fast enough as far as we're concerned, but it still is growing. And there are a lot of people around the state of Texas who don't want the death penalty. And that's good to know.
Will David give our regard to the other vigilants there?
We will, and definitely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Ray. Bye-bye.
All right. Now we go. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, Ray, oftentimes you'll hear, especially with people and prosecutors, that so-and-so is a poster child for the death penalty. That means that somebody's done something horrible, and that's the reason we have it. This is just the opposite. This case illustrates probably better than any case that we've ever had recently that the death penalty oftentimes is a product of the system that we've created ourselves. I think that when we examine this case and examine what went on in this case, I think the system is as much at fault as Jerry's conduct was at fault. And also it illustrates a point that we've harped about over and over again, is that you can't separate the death penalty from our penal institutions and the way our courts work. And the big problem I've always had with the death penalty is this, not that there aren't people who are dangerous and should be segregated from society. There's no doubt about that. We've talked about them.
Sure.
We've seen them. But the trouble is we haven't learned to do it right, and it sweeps within the scope of those people who are very dangerous, people like Jerry Martin. And let me explain why I say all of this.
You actually would have met Jerry.
I went up and met Jerry and spent some time talking to him, and I've talked to his family. I came up at Jerry's request. Susan Nash and I both went up and saw him last week. And, of course, I've read everything on the case, and here's what basically happened. This didn't just begin with the death of Susan Canfield, a prison guard. It started when he was 24 years old, even younger. Jerry was one of five children. He was the fourth in five children. Had some obvious emotional problems. He tried to commit suicide when he was 11. And oftentimes when people are depressed and get into that, they go to them, start using drugs, which is typically true of people with depression. And I didn't know the extent, because Jerry seemed very lucid and fine. Miss Susan, I talked to him, didn't see have any problems there. Was a very decent, good guy. And what happened, he continued in drugs and was using a lot of cocaine. And when he was 24 years old, he goes to his mother's house. And he's real depressed again. He's threatening to commit suicide, has a pistol with him. And his mother panicked. There never was any danger to any of the family. He wasn't threatening any of the family, wasn't threatening anybody. But he threatened to kill himself. And his mother panicked, called 911, trying to get the police to come out and keep him from killing himself. That's what it basically amounted to. And she calls 911. And when she calls 911, the police arrive and Jerry leaves. Jerry drives away in a red pickup truck. And at that point, he had done really nothing except threaten to kill himself. That's basically it. And he went off in the pickup truck. At this point, the policeman decided to chase him. And he chased him with sirens blasting, and that led to a high-speed chase in which like three or four more police cars got involved. There was gunshots exchanged. Now, nobody knows for certain what Jerry was shooting at. He was shooting out the back window. They don't know whether he's shooting in the air or shooting at the ground. No one was ever hit. Police car was never hit. And after a long, kind of extensive chase, he ends up in a field, turns his pickup around, and gets out of the pickup. And he has a gun in his mouth, like he's going to kill himself. And at this point, there's a standoff. And then they call in more policemen, including sharpshooters and a bunch of other folks. And there's some more shots fired. And they claim that during the shots being fired, Jerry said that a lot of them were fired in the ground. He didn't have had a pistol, so he didn't have a lot of ammunition, so there couldn't have been just a whole lot of shooting at anybody. But nonetheless, at trial, they claim that a bullet came close to one of the policemen. Now, what close means is anybody's guess. And got near another policeman. No one was ever injured. No one was ever hurt. Nobody was ever hit, and all the gunfire, nobody was damaged. And what happened? He goes to trial on this, and what really, this was just a mental health issue. It was not a criminal issue, but thanks to the standoff and thanks to all of the chasing with police cars.
Where did this happen?
Happened up in North Texas, and I've forgotten the name.
Collin County.
In Collin County, right outside of Dallas. So what happens, they charge him with two counts of attempted capital murder of a police officer and another aggravated assault. They give him 50 years in the penitentiary, 40 years and 20 years.
Would that have been handled different by the mental health courts in Harris County?
Of course it would have been. It would have been handled differently probably with most people. But then you always have that macho thing of when policemen claim someone shot at me and do that whining, prosecutors always kind of go for the throat. And this was a guy who had had no crimes of violence. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was injured. He gets a 50-year sentence. He hits TDC when he's 25. And what he's looking at, because it's an aggravated case involving a firearm, this means that jury's going to be locked up at least 25 more years, which means he's going to be 50 or 60 before he can be considered for parole. And that, and I think we're going to discuss that later on in the program with some more of the lawyers, creates a real problem because it means that people have not got a whole lot to lose. They're getting desperate, and they'll do desperate things.
Especially when you don't have the mental capacity to handle a lot of stuff.
Well, and also when you realize you've kind of been treated a little bit unfairly because nobody's hurt, nobody's injured. He gets a 50-year sentence, and that's just outrageous. But nonetheless, what happened, he teams up with a guy named John Falk, who's doing some time for killing a lawyer down in Matagorda County. He has a life sentence. So you've got two guys with these real long sentences.
And nothing to lose.
And so it's obvious they're going to try to get away and escape. So what happened, Jaron never had any problems, no discipline problems in prison, none whatsoever, no fights with guards.
Well, he's on the wind unit. He's a bureaucrat.
Even before that, he got transferred to the wind unit, interesting enough. You know why? He had an affair with one of the lady prison guards that liked him so well. They found out about it, and that's why he's transferred to the wind unit.
Yeah, but the wind unit's kind of the bureaucrat.
Right. Anyway.
I got wind people out there listening, right. So they're going to be writing me.
And so what happened, he and John Falk had planned an escape, and they were working on what we call the host squad. They were doing some work in the fields. And so they overpowered a guard. Jerry took the gun away from the guard and gave it to Falk, and both of them jumped a fence and began to run. Falk goes in one direction, hides behind some equipment, and Jerry heads toward a little service center parked in the building, parking that was in front of the prison. And there he found a flatbed truck, a ton and a half truck, had the keys in it. So he jumps in the truck to rescue Falk. He's going to drive back and get Falk. And in the meantime, Susan Canfield is a 59-year-old female prison guard.
And she was in charge.
She was on horseback, and she was what they call the high rider. She was outside the fence to kind of guard the perimeter. Well, she's on horseback, and of course there's a lot of shooting going on at this point. Her horse gets shot in the flank. So when Jerry comes running up to rescue Falk, this horse is pretty much out of control. And what happened, and I talked to Jerry about this, and I'll tell Jerry's story and I'll tell what the court claims or what they testified in trial. Jerry said that when he was driving up to get Falk, the horse was careening, about to butt the lady off, and got in front of the truck. He steered to the left to avoid the horse and hit the right side of the truck, hit the horse. And he said when he hit the horse, when he right side of the truck hit the horse, Susan Canfield was thrown over the pickup, hit the top of the pickup, then hit and landed on her head and shoulders, fractured her skull, and she died from a skull fracture. Interesting enough, the horse was not injured except for bruising. No broken bones on the horse, no broken bones on Ms. Canfield other than, of course, a skull fracture. And so at that point, he gets Falk. They then take off in the truck. They stop at a bank and get another car from a lady in a drive-in, and they take off. And, of course, they all get caught. He's caught about an hour later hiding in a tree, and they catch Falk. And then at that point, he's charged with capital murder, and they end up giving
Are both he and Falk charged?
Well, Falk got a mistrial. What's interesting in his case, he got a mistrial in his first case. And as a matter of fact, when I talked to Jerry, he'd been talking to David Weeks, the prosecutor, and he was giving a deposition in behalf of Falk before he's being executed. He's already done that in this period of time. And Jerry, unlike most of the inmates that we've talked to before, most people we've talked before, had nothing but praise for his trial lawyer. Just considered him a father figure.
And he got along well with David Weeks.
And got along with David Weeks real well.
He was the prosecutor.
And the prosecutor. And he also, and he had, like I said, nothing but praise for his lawyer and his appellate lawyer. And here's what he said. He said that when his father died, he was so close to his father that he realized what death meant, and he felt real horrible about causing the death of Susan Canfield. And that's why he decided to drop all of his writ appeals.
Become a volunteer.
He became a volunteer to die because he said, when I lost my father, I realized how much that hurt me. And I know what the Canfield family's going through because she, too, died.
Do we know where Falk is now?
Falk is awaiting trial.
It's awaiting trial.
Right. His first trial ended in a mistrial, and they haven't tried him yet, and he's waiting in a waiting trial.
Falk would, in this situation, be a law party's case.
Exactly. Because, Falk was what happened after they overcame the first guard. Jerry threw the gun he took from the guard to Falk. It only had 5 bullets in it because it was a .357 loaded with 5 rounds. And Falk started running, and most of the gunfire was directed toward Falk. And Jerry ran the other way and went to the service center. And then what happened, Susan Canfield, when she was shooting at Falk, too, and the guard shot the horse in the flank. And that's why the horse was out of control. And the horse bolted in front of the truck, and that's...
Oh, it wasn't either one of these that shot the horse. It was a guard that shot the horse.
Yeah, because, it couldn't have been Falk that had been shot in the front because the horse was heading toward him.
Yeah.
It had to be one of the guards. And, what the guards claim, and remember, all of these are prison guards who testified, and they claimed the following. They claimed at trial that he floorboarded the truck, that he was driving extremely fast, that he intentionally and deliberately hit the lady on the horseback. And we're going to discuss that further. I think Jackson will discuss whether or not that's true or not.
Susan, it's a little different when you do execution watch with a name on a piece of paper and when you actually go down and see these people.
This, out of all the cases we've talked about on the show, I would basically say what this case really stands for is... You could say the system worked the way it's designed to, so to speak. The law was followed. You know, everybody did their job. But the result was so unjust. The result, I think, is unjust.
Now, you're saying that because you actually went out and met this guy?
No. Meeting him and talking to him, yes, it certainly helps. But even if you look at his actual acts, even if you looked at it without meeting him, none of this, the original case of attempted capital murder of 2 police officers, this was a disturbed young man. This is not traditionally what you think of attempted capital murder. And, there's a whole range of things he could have been charged with. But the result of 50 years on the case, I don't think was just because he was acting out of emotion.
How would that case have wound up in the mental health courts in Harris County?
Well, it's hard to imagine.
I don't think the cops would file it that way.
Well, prosecutors had huge discretion of what they could have done. They obviously chose to take the maximum charge. They chose to prove up the case of the maximum charge. I don't think 50 years was justified in the case. I don't think it wasn't somebody acting out of like a premeditated intent. It was really somebody that was a disturbed person acting out of emotion.
And this is the case that he was in prison for which he was trying to escape.
And then it gets, of course, things get compounded in the case where he's trying to escape, that he's convicted of capital murder. What is fundamentally wrong, and if you ever read classical literature, if you studied theology, if you're a student of any of those things, what is fundamentally wrong here is this goes against our concepts of good and evil in a human being. The concept of executing people really comes from that some people are so evil, that they're so evil that they have a black heart, a depraved heart, and they're not part of the human race. And therefore, executing them, you're getting rid of the body.
You've got to qualify them to be the other.
Okay, but what I'm saying is this is not, if you look at the actual acts he committed that they used to prove up the offense, he does nothing inherently evil. Once again, the escape is acting out of emotion. It's not rational. He does not prey on women. He does not prey on children, elderly people. He does not commit any horrific...
He probably doesn't have any intent in this present case.
He does not commit any abhorrent or horrific act against any other human being. Susan Canfield was a female, but he did not... Nobody targeted a woman for a crime. It was obviously by circumstance. In fact, he didn't intend to kill anybody. And so what's wrong here is... This is somebody that acted out of emotion.
You know, actually, prison's full of people where the intent is lacking.
I mean, to go in for these type of acts and end up with
Trust
a death
me, I've been
sentence.
Trying to get somebody out of prison for 22 years.
But Ray, on death row, the intent obviously is more often there than not in death row cases.
Well, I don't doubt that. I don't say that it's not often there. I'm just saying that. And the other thing, Jim, as long as we're killing people, there's relatively little wrong with just mistreating somebody.
But even you still have to separate him from the many other people who committed far different acts.
Well, I'm going,
and that's what he asked me to do.
Yeah, and I'm going to ask the audience to conjure their thoughts on these words while we go to Dr. Joel Zivit. Doctor?
Yes, hi.
You're a physician.
I am.
Where did your interest in executions derive?
Well, the word interest is an interesting one. I think it's certainly, I have a concern about it. And I have a concern about it because it's become increasingly evident that execution in its present state has tried to usurp, if you will, the way that medicine is practiced. It's created in a sense that it gives an impression that execution is a medical act. And I've taken note of this and I've commented on this because I want it to be clear and that execution is not a medical act and not subject to the safety and control of the practice of medicine.
And in your professional life, somebody has got to have decided that this combination of chemicals is going to be lethal that it is supposed to be a more humane process than electrocutions or hanging or beheading. Isn't that part of medical culture?
Well, I think that, you know, you raise some interesting points. You know, the problem for doctors is that doctors are not trained to be executioners. We don't think like that. That's not our knowledge base, and certainly the tools of our trade that we use are never intended to be used in the way that they are now being used in the setting of execution. Now, the other problem is that physicians, we understand, or rather our national organizations have made it pretty clear that physicians are not supposed to comment or assist from an ethical perspective on anything to do with execution. Not again what we are knowledgeable about, nor do we wish to be engaged in discussion. Now, in a way, I think our silence potentially has created a problem. It's created a problem on two fronts. On the one hand, you know, there might be an impression that the silence of physicians therefore allows it to take place because they're not speaking out against it. And secondly, because execution attempts to use some of the tools of my trade, the language of what it is that I do, then people might imagine that execution has some kind of safety and assurance that it actually is creates or doesn't result in cruelty or suffering, undue cruelty or undue suffering. And I would object the characterization of it most strongly in that regard.
Well, in your thesis, the absence of cruelty is not the presence of humaneness. You rather poignantly challenge any doctors deciding to participate in this process.
Well, I think that the, you know, as a physician, we understand that we don't want to stand idly by, and we don't, and there is a duty to rescue, is one way of putting it. And so if we see someone who is suffering, we might imagine that we have a role there. Now, there are a couple of things here. That a condemned person is not my patient, and so I don't have a doctor-patient relationship with that person. That's not to say that as a citizen I don't have concerns, but it must be clear that in terms of the way that I practice, that person is not my patient. And secondly, and I think that physicians might imagine that by their participation that they may somehow reduce suffering. And I understand that comes from a good place. I appreciate that. However, I think that I can't imagine that the small participation that a physician might do around the time of execution would have anything to do with reducing the suffering, the anticipation of execution that people who are on death row presently experience. So to suggest that I could come in the last few minutes and do something and there would be some benefit to that, I frankly think that's quite a hard argument to make.
Well, ultimately, the business of trials and preparation for punishment are about the person accused and what they have done. And I can understand why that aspect of it is all about them and what they've done. But isn't execution itself in reality about us and what we do?
I think that we are all participants. I think that the thing that I find most troubling about lethal injection, and I even hesitate to use the terminology because, again, I feel like it's stealing my
language.
My language. And even when you say words like gurney or injection or anything at all like this, these are all medical terms. And they're not ever intended to be used around an execution. You know, for example, if I use a particular kind of chemical, in my hand, that chemical is a medicine with the purpose of curing. But in the hands of the executioner, that is now a chemical with the intention of killing. That's a very different sort of thing that's already at play. And I think that because most folks may have a sense or an impression or even have had an anesthetic or have heard about it, they may think, well, that's all that's going on here. It's safe and fine. But there is no data, there is no experimentation that would ever show that these sorts of things can be used in the way that they're used and as if there's some kind of protection or safe oversight. I think that what's worse, I think, is that because execution has now is now carried out in this form, I think it's skewed the debate in that people, I think that if execution was done in some other sort of way and not with injection, that it might focus what exactly is really going on here. What is really going on here is that one human being is killing another. And somehow with injection, it doesn't seem to be so rough and it feels civilized.
The use of these chemicals in this process, and I'm trying to show some respect for your concern about the language, this is not a chemical on-off switch for life, is it? You give somebody, induce these chemicals into their body. The process of the body coping with that is time-consuming. It's not instant.
Well, there is, you know, when I use a medicine, if I use a chemical that I'll call a medicine, in order for it to be allowed to be injected into a person for any purpose, it must undergo the most rigorous sort of investigation and evaluation and to be shown to be, on balance, more safe than harmful. Now, what's happened here is that this is being turned around on its head. And in fact, and again, without a physician oversight, there is no physician oversight here to say that these things are okay, nor will there ever be, that somehow the negative consequence or the negative effect of these chemicals are being employed. And there is this impression, again, that somehow they've been shown to be, quote, safe to do this. Like, it's hard even to make a sentence that makes any sense in the kind of twisting of the terminology here. There is no safety here. There is no guarantee. There's no guarantee that there's no suffering. There's no guarantee that there's no cruelty. There's none of those guarantees that people imagine are taking place. Merely what occurs is that a person dies. And there's no way of telling except by appearance. And that's a very loose evaluation of whether someone is really suffering or if there's really cruelty that is occurring in the consequence of this activity.
Dr. Gerald Zivit is an legal educator, is a medical director at Emory University Hospital, Midtown, Atlanta. Does Emory have your essay, your abstract available?
Well, it's open access, so anyone can search it. Let me say also that, of course, I'm speaking now on my own behalf. I'm not speaking as a representative of my present position.
Sure. Sure, we know those caveats are necessary.
Yeah. But the article that I wrote, was on my own concern, my ethical concern, and I specifically, wanted to publish it in what's called an open access, which means that anybody can download it for free as long as they have access to a computer and my name, then they can find it.
Okay, and that name is spelled Joel Zivot.
Z like zebra, I, V like Victor, O-T.
Dr. Zivit, I appreciate your being on Execution Watch, and thank you for adding to our understanding.
Yes, thank you for your program, and good luck.
Thank you. And there you go. And so now we're back. And Larry, you've got a piece of this?
Yes, Ray. There are a few issues that were raised. One, the potential or possibility of this, the incident when Jerry Martin was 24 years old and got the 50 years. Whether there was any likelihood that he was actually attempting suicide by cop. And then what role the police and the prosecutors played in that whole process. When the police are called, they have to come out. And Jerry's mother called them because he was intoxicated and high and had a gun. And her fear was that he might commit suicide. The police, as much of that as they may or may not have known, they don't really, when police come out, they don't, they act as they have been trained to act. And that is to take over the situation and to control the situation and to reduce the threat. So they acted in the manner in which they had been trained. Jerry apparently showed some suicidal tendencies. So in addition to the sharpshooters and so forth that they called out, they didn't have a mental health unit and didn't call one of those out, apparently. But they did call out a negotiator. And he was at least talked down. So when the police took over the situation, they did the high speed chase and so forth may have increased the level of danger. But
adrenaline rushes in those kinds of situations.
And the police don't necessarily they act in every situation pretty much the way that they've been trained. And because the adrenaline does take over, they have to act in the manner that they've been trained.
They're as high as he is, but only they're doing it with body chemicals.
Exactly. But when you get to the courthouse, the prosecutor is they actually conduct the orchestra at that point. And the prosecutors, who have the great level of discretion that they do, decided to pursue the highest level of punishment that they could. That is the death penalty.
Excuse me just a moment. We have a report from Huntsville. put Dennis on. Dennis?
Yes, Ray.
You have a report.
Yes, the execution has ended. It ended about 5 minutes ago, I would say. There were actually no witnesses for Jerry. Whatever was originally scheduled did not take place.
So only witnesses were media witnesses.
Media witnesses and perhaps witnesses for Officer Canfield.
Yeah.
We never know. They get there and they are brought into the actual walls unit before 5 o'clock in an effort to try to protect them from what they consider to be kind of hassle and whatnot from vigilance. But anyway, there were no witnesses for Jerry Martin. As I said, his brother was here. He was on the corner. He has gone over to the local church where they will hold the body until they'll bring it down to Houston for embalming purposes, and then they're going to take it back to their home and bury him in the grave site next to his father who recently passed away. So it was a very, very difficult moment for them, of course.
It's a difficult moment for us all, Dennis. Was there any noise from the other demonstration?
No, I could not hear anything from the other side, and as I said previously, I really don't know how many people were there. When I first arrived at the corner, there was a young woman standing there, and I heard her talking on the phone to somebody. It was clear that she was there in support of the execution, and so I pointed out to her that there often was a crowd of people who would be supporters on that other corner, and she actually ended up going across there. So I know there were other vigilants there, but I don't know how many.
Well, thank you very much for keeping us informed, Dennis. Next time I'm in Huntsville, I'll have to call you up.
Sounds like a deal.
Thank you, Professor.
Sure thing. Bye.
I didn't mean to interrupt you, Larry, but somebody get the phone for me. No, they got to push it out there. That's what those folks are for. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt, but we needed to know. What Dennis is talking about is whenever someone is executed, Carnes Funeral Services, which has the contract to handle the body, takes it to a small chapel not far from the place of execution, where the family can touch the body while it is still warm. I know that's morbid, but the fact of the matter is they have not touched this member of their family for the entire time that that person has been on death row, and perhaps before that in county jail. And so it's the only human contact they will have with them at this point. I'll leave you to mull that while we go back to Larry's discussion.
Well, Jerry's brother expressed the opinion that the incident that occurred back when Jerry was about 24 years old was probably an incident of suicide, attempted suicide by cop. But when it gets to the courthouse, then it becomes the society, the state of Texas versus Jerry Martin for having done acts against the peace and dignity of the state of Texas. And the prosecutor went after him with everything, including a failure to appear case. So everything that they had, he made bond and didn't show up in court, so they hit him with a failure to appear. So and all of that is the prosecutor acts on behalf of really the citizens. So we have decided through our elected officials to take Jerry Martin's life, which now raises the question, you mentioned him earlier being a volunteer, whether he's actually committing suicide, actually committed suicide.
So this may be a fait accompli of something that started many years ago.
It raises that possibility that maybe he did commit suicide by state.
Well, he saved us a few bucks. I mean, normally it would cost about $2 million to handle the appeals in one of these cases, wouldn't it, Jim?
It cost quite a bit, but really the reason I talked to Jerry about this, and he said what made him make up his mind, he didn't have the depression he would normally associate with somebody wanting to commit suicide. He said that, and this was unusual, he's extremely close to his family. He said when his father died, he just broke his heart. And he realized how the Canfield family must be suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt he had to do something as best he could to make up for what he had done. And that's why he decided to waive his rights to appeal, because he knew what it's like to lose somebody. And he wanted to get it over with. That's what he said. It wasn't, I don't think, his desire to commit suicide. I think he felt horrible because of Susan, I mean, his father's death.
Susan was there too, Susan. What's
well,
your impression?
I would also add to that is when we were visiting Jerry, I mean, Jerry was very clear about that he didn't really commit any of the horrible acts that some other people have committed that are executed. And that was exactly his main point.
Yeah, well, ultimately,
I didn't deserve to die and get condemned to be executed for the acts I did.
This is Job's story.
Okay, but that...
Only God didn't restore it.
But that basically was... He made that point very clearly. He asked me to express that point on the show, which I'm doing. And he also said that, I mean, even that basically living on death row was not particularly what he considered a life.
Well, that's understandable. Mike, you want to elbow in here?
I sure do. 37 years of being a criminal lawyer, and a case like this stuns me. Let me say something to you. They might execute him tonight.
A little closer to the mic.
They might execute him tonight. But this is a man, based on what I see, is going to go to heaven because he hasn't sinned. What are we doing? We have a troubled youth who at 11 tries to kill himself, at 24 tries to kill himself. And he goes through the system with no heart, with nobody offering a handout to help him. We have a system right now that you're arrested, you put on probation, and if you screw up, you go to prison. Of course you're going to screw up. You got arrested. You got an attitude. You have a reason why you don't fit in, and you got probation officers who are going to revoke you. We need a better system. The trouble we have in America is we have an agriculture-based society that the turn of the century went industrial. We took the families off the farm. The fathers and the families that come to the cities will give you jobs. There's no jobs. There's no more families. There's no more fathers. What are young men supposed to do growing up? They need to bond with some other young men. They're bonding with other people like them. We need a better program. We need to take people at first arrest and do some kind of pretrial diversion. We need to get them to a program where they're educated, they get jobs, they feel good about themselves, and they bond with other young men trying to help themselves. We used to have systems in this country called civilian corps that helped people during the Depression. We had it during the 60s. We had VISTA. We had Job Corps. We had George Foreman, who was a great success, who was a thug in the streets. They took him in Job Corps, changed his life, and he now became productive. We're not doing that. We're taking young men and throwing them away. We can't afford to do that. We need to make people realize there's hope after being arrested.
Mike, don't you suspect that some of those other guys on death row that are listening to this show, and I know you're listening, fellas, because Jerry told me you were, in a letter. I didn't see Jerry personally like Jim and Susan did, but he and I exchanged several notes in the preparation of the show. How many of these throwaway kids?
There's an expression that I've learned in my life, and that is real simple. Never judge a man on what he does before he's 35. There's two different lives of a man.
That's not the way the law is written,
Mike. I understand that. But our key is to get them to 35 alive. Our key is to get them to an environment where they can be successful by bonding with other men like them who want to be successful. What we do, though, is reject him at 18 or 19 years old. You got a young boy who lost his father, lost his family, feels alone and dejected in the world. He tries to kill himself, and the end result is they kill him? We're not Christians if that's what we do. We need to reach out and understand. And let me explain one thing. The one thing we need to do is keep him employed. We used to have something called weekend service, which meant if you had a job and you got in trouble, you went to jail for the weekends. That's punishment. But you can keep your job, you can keep your pension, you can keep your health insurance, you can support your families. You're punished on the weekend, but you have a hope to get out because you'll have your family. You got something to come back to.
I think this hope stuff is important. All right. I went to prison sentenced to 160 years. They stole my hope. All right. No question about it. They stole my hope. However, when I got down there, I found useful things to do that made me feel as if I could accomplish something there.
You bonded with positive people that made a difference in your life. We're not giving the people the opportunity. The best people to bond with are people with the same problems. We take
But Jim suggested that you ought to be an ex-convict to be a prison guard.
You should be an ex-convict to be a prison guard, to be a probation officer, maybe even be a police officer. But
I want to be sure and squeeze Jack Lee in here because I am still worrying. Where's the intent in Canfield's death?
I don't think there was one. If you look at the from the evidence that was on the of the accident, and I'll go ahead and call it an accident because I really do believe it was. He's trying to escape.
Now, if you didn't go visit the guy, you're not working on a business story. What you're working on is what you were able to find in the study.
That's correct. That's correct. And, I mean, I think it's telling what happened to the horse. For anybody who's ever hit a deer, which I have, you know, you...
down your scooter, was it?
I was in college, and it was in a car.
I got to the scene where someone hit a deer while it was still fresh enough to eat.
Right, and you know the animal, the deer, is basically pulverized. It's sausage. The bones are broken up. The ligaments are torn, and so on and so forth. Because
that's
the way it is. If you're hitting something at a high speed, that's what happens. And the prison guards were saying that Jerry Martin would, at high speed, would hit the horse, yet the horse did not suffer any broken bones. Impossible. Physically impossible.
The horse was shot in the butt by another officer.
Right. And when you do that to a horse, they turn around in circles because they're trying to get to the pain. That you do that to a person, they turn around and because they're trying to get to the pain. If the human body is very, very fragile. At 35, a NHTSA reports suggest that the human body can survive up to about a 35 mile per hour impact. A 35 mile per hour impact. We think of that as very slow. Bones break at a significantly lower speed. Ms. Canfield had no broken bones. That's the physical evidence. I'm just not – and if Martin were actually trying to ram the horse and the Ms. Canfield, why is it that it was – that the damage to the truck was on the right-hand side? Again, that too doesn't make sense. It makes sense what Mr. Martin said makes sense. He saw the horse came, charged. He was trying to miss the horse. He turned to the left and still struck the horse and Miss Canfield with the right side of the car.
That makes good sense. Jack, if you're trying to escape, you know the damage that can be done by hitting something. The last thing you want to do is just damage your escape vehicle. Right. You don't want to hit things. You want to avoid things so you can be able to run away. And it'd be stupid to run over a horse if you're trying to escape because it damaged your escape vehicle. It'd be stupid.
Sure. I really don't think this was intentional. I think it was an accident, a terrible accident, a terrible accident.
Well, excuse me. It's time for me to start to work on the wrap-up, but... There seems to be a consensus in this room of all of those of us on execution watch, and sometimes we come to a consensus. Often we don't come to a consensus.
Before the show we weren't, but we're kind of getting together.
Well, the thing about it is that there's some serious questions about intent in the commission of the crime for which he was executed.
I agree.
There's some serious questions about intent in the commission of the crime for which he got 50 years.
That was really awful, too.
Okay, so this is Job, except God doesn't show up at the last minute and replenish everything that Job has lost. Instead, God says, come on up, and the state of Texas assists Jerry Martin to get to the other side of some kind of transition. It's difficult to do this show, and I want to take just a minute here to talk to you guys on death row. We're trying our best within the confines of journalism accuracy to tell your story. I know some of you are really bad dudes, and you don't want to talk to me and have an interview on the show. I understand that. Because you know that then you've got to deal with the realities of your own life and your own crime. Others of you, like Jerry, don't really want that to happen, but you wanted to talk to the lawyers, and for Jerry, that worked. That worked. Susan came in, and this is a different case for her. Even old Jim, who's got calluses in places where most of us don't even have places. Old Jim.
And young Susan.
It touched his heart.
Well, used to be, but go ahead.
Young, nubile Susan.
Right, yeah, it touched his heart. We do care about what we do for you fellas. We're not going to pretty it up. If the newspapers and the court records say this and that, we're going to report that. But if you want a place at that table, then you respond to the invitation you receive from Elizabeth for us to come up and interview. And that interview is not just audio recorded. We tape record it. My name is Ray Hill, and we have been luing Execution Watch. Jerry Martin is dead. I want to thank Dr. Joel Zivit for adding his piece to the puzzle. I want to thank Dennis Longmire from Huntsville, Dave Atwood from Houston. Our fine legal team, led by Jim Skelton and ably survived by, or ably carried forth by, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee. We could not do this program without the awfully hard work of Elizabeth Stein, our producer. The next execution is Edgardo Cubas, and that is going to happen on January the 16th. Have a happy new year, and maybe he will get a stay, and we will then be reprieved until the next schedule. My name is Ray Hill. This is KPFT in Houston. Thank you for listening.